Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Post Bougie podcast for the week of August 21st. I'm Monica. I'm coming to you from Washington, D.C. And just a few blocks down the street is our good friend Jamel.
Hello. Hello.
And way down in Florida where it's really hot is Joel.
Hey, what's going on?
All right. So today we're going to talk about three things that should rile everyone's blood during the crazy season.
I'm already riled.
Yeah, we came in riled, and we're just gonna get even more so.
Don't let my monotone fool you.
The first one is talking about culture and what it means, and how when people talk about culture and poverty, they seem to misunderstand what that word means. The second thing we'll talk about is this article about lazy do-nothing 20-somethings in the New York Times Magazine. And the third thing we'll talk about is Dr. Laura, who you may be surprised to learn was still alive and still had a radio show, during which she said really offensive things. All right. So the first, I guess we can talk about this idea of culture. John McWhorter kind of reignited an old debate about the role that culture plays in reinforcing poverty, specifically as it relates to the African-American community. And I wrote a post for The Prospect basically about how people misunderstand culture, and even sociologists who talk about the role culture plays don't mean what the vast majority of people think it means. And so, I basically wrote, when anthropologists and sociologists talk about culture, particularly when they're talking about its relation to poverty, they're not talking about things like music and shoes, which is what the American public thinks culture means. They're talking about culture as a tool to relate to the world. And it's a system of values and beliefs and a framework that you use to understand the conditions of the earth. And, poverty and racism and exclusion and isolation can shape your culture. But culture, it doesn't mean that you can sit around in a room and say, hey, guys, let's change our culture. And you can just like make it. So that's not what people are talking about. And I tend to think this debate is mostly misplaced anyway, but I think people latch on to it because they think culture means individual behavior, and so they look for an excuse to blame, particularly, I think, African Americans for their own situations in life. And so they think culture is the thing they can peg that blame on. So I was wondering if you guys had any thoughts about that as well.
My God, doesn't even sound like the McWhorter I know. Oh my God, he thinks, black people are to blame for,
I mean, I don't know about you guys, but if black people start listening to rap music and letting their pants sag, then they'd be a lot further in this world,
Yeah, right.
Exactly. I mean, that's what people think it means.
I've never worn baggy pants, didn't listen to rap music until I got to college. And hey, I got to college, case in point.
Exactly. You prove it.
Right. Well, this is always that the argument that if only black people would straighten up and fly right, then we wouldn't have to worry about racism. If only we were acceptable to not only ourselves and everybody else, that somehow that would just, break the chains of racism and everything would be okay. As if listening to, Too Short, holds the future, over black America,
Yeah, that's what's ridiculous about it.
And Too Short, it probably is a cumulatively negative effect. I mean, just in general, but I don't know if that's exclusive to black.
Well, I got really mad about this because a Daily Dish reader responded, and Daily Dish writers have this habit of just like posting reader responses without comment onto their blog, and he was like, it makes me really mad to think that it's our culture that's causing this, because all we have to do is change our mindset and then we could end racism in a generation.
I mean, doesn't that sound exactly like what Bill Cosby has, like the line of bullshit he's been pushing for like the last 10 years, essentially?
Exactly. And
I think this might be different than a little different than Cosbyism, right? Because Cosbyism just sounds sort of like a variation of what I've heard growing up my whole life. Like if black people just get together and take it seriously, like to take things seriously, you know, they'd be better off, which is still bullshit. Like, it's still not the case, but I think it's something a little different than saying, you know, the cultural traditions of Black people are keeping them sort of behind. I'm not sure Bill Cosby would say Black people culture is what the problem is. They might say, like, you know,
he would say modern day culture. He might say modern day Black culture. Maybe not, you know, of the Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois school of thought, but yeah, he might say today's, this more, you know, recent generation of Black people. He might think that our culture might actually be responsible, because, I mean, he talks about, you know, wearing Jordans and listening to rap and naming our kids Bonquisha, you know, things like that.
Because back in the day, it was better.
Yeah, right.
So, and all of this made me mad, especially because a couple weeks ago, I'd read this William Julius Wilson's study, and he's a Harvard sociologist who spends his time studying the culture of poverty, basically. And you know, there is serious work to be done to kind of look at the ways that the cultural toolkit that people bring to the world affects their socioeconomic status, but it's also arrived at by socioeconomic status. And cultural toolkit doesn't mean, you know, the music that they listen to by choice. It just means, you know, the language that they use and then the interactive norms that they're used to understanding. And so it's like, if you're from a very isolated and poor community and you're trying to get a job in a big company with a white middle class manager who's interviewing you, you just don't bring the same cultural skills that other people from that same group would bring to it. And so, like, those are the kinds of things that people talk about when they talk about cultural barriers to overcoming poverty. It has nothing to do with the things that you choose to do in your everyday life. It has to do with the way that your world is shaped by the economic and social isolation that the community that you're in is in. And so, you know, he was talking about the serious work that is to be done to try to tease out what can be done to try to counteract those effects. But there's a danger in it, because people think that culture means the same thing as, like, as individual choice and individual action. And so the minute you use the word culture, people are just ready to blame poor people, particularly for their own situations. And
exercise agency completely over your own culture, right? I mean,
exactly. That you can just, like, that every individual person has the power to interact in every situation in the way that would advance them, you know, without and also without other people bringing cultural expectations to it as well. So,
right. Well, I also thought that kind of the interesting part near the end of your post in particular was when you talk about, like, I'm not going to just limit it to Black people, but I think a lot of times when people are having these debates about culture, and you say people are, you know, want to, like, come up with all these other sociological, socioeconomic, you know, excuses isn't the word, but reasons for why, you know, people in the Ozarks, you know, lower income whites in the Ozarks, or, you know, the Deep South, or, you know, whatever, you know, regions where there's, like, concentrated pockets of, like, white poverty. And they'll say, oh, well, you know, I can understand there's these structural things that are preventing them, you know, there's poverty, you know, entrenchment there. You know, they would never say, well, they listen to country music, you know, or Poison, and that's and that's to blame for that. But whenever, you know, whenever Black people come into this equation, whenever we're talking about Black people and culture, then all of a sudden it becomes, well, you know, certainly they have the ability to change their circumstances, which, I mean, on a certain level is true, but collectively not really, you know. I mean, there's a lot of things that come with that, and yeah, I thought that was a really important point that you made there. So
I would add too that, like, the thing that bothers me is that oftentimes when we're talking in, like, public conversations, when we're talking about Black people, 9 times out of 10 what we mean are sort of a relative minority of Black people in hyper segregated, economically isolated urban areas.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Like, that's it would be as if in talking about the problems of Appalachia, we were like, white people across the country need to get their act together. It's like, well, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've talked about this a little bit around the office too, Jamel, but it's like, it's kind of this like allure of like a stupidly simplistic argument, but it's like, you know, the situation broadly of African Americans in this country can just be described by laziness, right? Like, right. It's like, it's so easy to solve this problem that like, but I mean, also it's like, yeah, that was my point too, where it's like, talking about isolated, lower income whites as well. Like, actually people do spend a lot of time talking about how nuanced it is, right? Like, that's what Jim Webb does. And that's what all these people do. It's like, people accept that it's a really nuanced and complicated situation for lower income whites, but broadly among the popular culture, just like, when it comes to African Americans, people are just willing to talk about the simplest thing, you know?
Right. And even if we're talking about culture and the way that people tend to misunderstand it, we wouldn't even be, I mean, it's really stupid. Again, we always come back to this, you know, black people are not a monolith. Like, the black people, you know, the communities I grew up around, you know, I went to a private school in Houston. I grew up, my family wasn't affluent, but we were a relatively middle class group of people. And I mean, the people that we hung out, you know, as a result, they tended to be middle class. I mean, most of the people I grew up with, they went off to college, you know, they graduated from college. They're doing well for the most part. But I mean, for somebody to say, well, you know, that quote culture of that group of black people has the same in common with, like, you know, a group of black people who grew up in the projects in, you know, New Orleans, or, you know, in New York or something, that grew up in Queensbridge. I mean, it's stupid, right? I mean, even still, there's differences among those individual people. But in as much as that you can break out and say, well, there's a particular culture that's particular to the people that live here, it's not even the same thing, you know? So I don't know. And then also, these complaints about culture are like old, you know? Like, this has been going on. I mean, there's been a lot of research done to back in the 1920s, where even there was like a divide among people saying, well, you know, black people, you know, if only they would do better, you know, if only they would do better, then white people wouldn't hate us. I mean, so it's like this happens over and over again, every generation. There's nothing new about this. And so, like, the same person that's complaining about, quote, black culture now, the generation that preceded him was complaining about his generation. So, I don't know. So.
Yeah, that's true, too.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. It's really dispiriting. Right. Anyway, moving on to topic two, I think our second topic is going to be introduced by Joel, who's going to tell us about how 20-somethings just don't want to grow up anymore.
Yeah, speaking about the current generation, come on.
Yeah, right. I mean, I don't have anything in common with you 20-year-olds. I mean, being that I'm in my 30s now, and clearly I'm an adult. But in the New York Times Magazine, coming up, they have this, well, you know, it's the New York Times Magazine, so it's a rather lengthy article about, you know, why people in their 20s are taking so long to, quote, grow up. And there's kind of like this, I guess this movement being made as a psychology professor in Massachusetts who's talking about looking at the 20s as like this distinct life stage, and he calls it emerging adulthood, where essentially, you know, in the past, there have been these traditional markers for what people are expected to do, right? Like, you know, they move out on their own, they become financially independent, they get married, they have children, you know, yada yada. But he's saying, recently, apparently this is a recent development, at least according to this piece, is that, you know, people are delaying their adulthood. You know, there's not, you know, people are waiting later to get married. They're taking longer to get into their careers. You know, people, I think there was a number in the story that says something about people in their 20s, they may have as many as 7 jobs in their 20s. And, you know, they're not as able to be financially independent from their parents, yada, yada, yada. So at any rate, what it comes down to is that 20-year-olds just want to be children again. You know, I was really skeptical before I started reading the piece. Like, I was like, oh my god, this is some bullshit. But it's actually relatively interesting. I mean, you can see that there are some flaws in this theory, but I mean, I do think it's really interesting. And so, you know, you guys can kind of take it from here. I mean, Jamel is a one of those lazy 20-year-olds.
I am shockingly lazy, actually. So this strikes me as one of those articles that should be a lot more specific in what it's actually talking about. It's inaccurate. I haven't read it, so, you know, take my criticism with a grain of salt. But I feel that it might be more accurate to say that for 20-somethings, like for white 20-somethings from an upper middle to upper class background, there's an extended 20s, or an extended childhood that it goes well into the 20s. But in my experience, just so folks know, I grew up from Virginia Beach, nice, happy middle class family neighborhood, but a lot of classmates who came from like less than middle class families and so on and so forth. And, you know, I get a quick perusal of my Facebook friends shows that, like, a ton of my high school classmates are married, are settled into their jobs and all that jazz. And so I think this is very much a class thing. Like, for young, like, creative professionals, certainly. Like, there's this extended period of adolescence of sorts, due in part to the fact that trying to be a young creative professional is not a particularly good, like, choice for financial security. But for others, that might not be the case. Speaking for myself, like, I don't think my parents pay for anything, so...
Right.
Yeah, I felt that too. I mean, I only read a little bit of the article because I get really annoyed by the New York Times Magazine, as everybody knows, but, like, I totally agreed with you. Like, it was like... It's one of those things where it's so obviously aimed at the people who read the Times, right? Like, these are the kids of the people who read the Times. And so that's why they did this article. I also could not depend on my parents. And so I never did this. Like, I wish I could have moved home after graduating from college, because I probably could have had a better time of it financially. You know what I mean? Like, the number of Americans who graduate from college is still really low. Like, I don't think it's higher than 30%. So this is a very small portion of the population that we're talking about.
I would also add that, like, the majority of those Americans graduated from college aren't graduating from, like, East Coast elite institutions, right? Like, they're graduating from, you know, Old Dominion University or Florida State University.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
And in all fairness, there was a little bit more. I mean, obviously, it went on and on and on and on and on and on. So there's a little bit more nuance to this guy's argument. I think, though, what kind of struck me is that, like, the guy is sort of equating, like, adulthood with maturity. Like, as if, you know, if you reach these sort of milestones, then you're mature, or even that you're an adult. And, you know, it kind of excludes some people. And, I mean, this is sort of touched on in here, but, you know, say you don't want children, you know, say you don't want to have a romantic partner, you know, say you don't want to be in a relationship. They're looking at, like, adulthood as, like, this amorphous thing that, like, you know, it could start, like, you're allowed to serve in the military at 18, but you're allowed to drink at 21, but you're not able to rent a car with, like, all these penalties until you're 25. Like,
it sucks, by the way. Just throw that out.
Yeah. Oh, man, it's terrible. I mean, I rented cars all the time. You know, like, when I got out of college and I had a job and, you know, I had to go on assignments, I preferred to drive, but I had to pay, like, all these fees, you know, just to rent a stupid car. But, yeah. And so I think, like I said, there's some nuance to the piece, but, like I said, yeah, you guys are right, though. It really applies to a very narrow group of people. Like you said, I mean, maybe a fourth of people get their college degrees in this country, right? And so for these other people, like, these markers are, like, thrust upon them. They have to be financially independent, or, you know, there's all these other, you know, they have to provide for themselves. There's not an option. It is like, well, there's no, like, you know, I want to go backpacking through the Alps, because it's not even an option, you know?
Yeah, and I found I actually kind of stopped reading a little bit after it talked about the people it was excluding because, you know, it excludes me. And I'm like, I'm 30. Like, just so everyone knows, I'm 30 and I'm totally an adult. And I don't own my own house and I'm not married and I don't have kids. And it's just, like, really offensive to me that, you know, and I'm like, Jamel, everybody from my high school cohort is already married with children. And some of the children are pretty old because they got married really young. That idea that, you know, I'm still not an adult because I haven't just had a baby, which frankly is pretty easy to do. Like,
yeah, like stupid people can have really, children.
Exactly. Like, that is really offensive to me. You know, it's right. Like, it's just 9 months of incubation time. Like, if that were super important, I would have pulled it off by now, you know? Like, and so, but I do get that when I go home, like this kind of, you know, I'm still like kind of a kid, like a young adult to people who are older than me and people even who are my peers. That idea too, that like, I've been just kind of flitting about my life.
Right.
Because I haven't settled down is just also really annoying to me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and for me, it kind of like, I mean, you talk, I'm 32, right? And I just got married this year. But like, I mean, I rent, you know, I you know, it's not really a conversation for the podcast, but children is something that like, I'm really like ambivalent about. But, you know, for somebody to say that like, I haven't like reached these milestones of adulthood, well then maybe we should just, going back to the point thing, then the problem is with the traditional markers of adulthood, not like the people that make these decisions, right? Because we get to make these choices. And like you said, I know plenty of people who had children at very young ages. That doesn't mean anything. You might just be a bad parent, or you know, you said, well, hey, I didn't want to move away. You know, I didn't want to go off to school. I wanted to stay here, whatever. I mean, but people get to make these decisions, but to like classify them in terms of like adulthood and maturity is kind of where I think we run into these problems, you know?
Yeah. I'm an adult, people.
Right. Yeah. I don't need to prove anything to you all. Right.
Exactly.
Take care of myself.
For the record, I'm not an adult. I'm 23 years old. I can barely tie my shoes.
Yeah. Oh, no, I was going to say, I support Jamel not being an adult for as long as possible.
and one quick thing, too. I think, like, we have some of these discussions about, like, what should we do with these kids or these, you know, emerging adults. I think, like, this is when it kind of comes back to, like, having safety nets like universal health care. Like, there wouldn't be some of this, like, hand-wringing, you know, about, like, what are we going to do? These people that are, like, not quite able to, you know, defend for themselves and take care of these expenses. But like, if there was like some sort of real safety net for people that like needed to figure things out or didn't know exactly what they wanted to do, or people who just can't, you know, for whatever reason, they're entrenched in poverty or living paycheck to paycheck, and you know, one illness could, you know, put them into poverty or homelessness, that's maybe, I would like to have seen some mention of that. Like,
That's one of the big things about the piece too, where it's like, you know, if we decided that this was like a problem, then what should be easy? It should be easier to move into adulthood then, right? Then there's obviously a problem with the social safety net that allows people to build wealth. And I would add
too that this seems like almost kind of kicking, like being a little unfair to the current crop of at least early 20-somethings. Because remember, you know, if you graduated in 2008, 2009, 2010, you graduated into the collapse of the global economy, right?
Right.
Like when I graduated, like 4 months before I graduated from college, there was serious talk about us entering a second Great Depression. So it's a little unfair to say, oh man, these 20-somethings are so lazy, they're not like getting jobs. It's like, well, I don't... Hey, newsflash, there aren't really that many jobs available.
Right.
Particularly for young workers without experience, too.
Right.
That's for people with degrees, right?
Right, exactly.
Right.
I mean, for people with degrees, for young graduates, I think the unemployment rate is somewhere around 8 or 9%.
Right.
Like, if you don't have a high school degree, it's around 20-something%. If you... Or, sorry, no, 16 or 17%. If you have some college, it's higher at around 10%. So it's not as if you have a bunch of college graduates or young college graduates who are just being lazy. Like, it's genuinely hard to find a job, and a decent job at that. something that actually like furthers your career goals, and whatnot.
Yeah, they're not just sitting around trying to find themselves. And it's also, I'd just add to that too, in addition to being a horrible job market, it's also, there's also a really pressurized rental market as well, right? Like, it's just really hard to be a young adult right now.
Right.
There are a lot of things adding to that as well. But yeah, no, I mean, we'll cry for Jamel's cohort another time.
It sucks.
Jamel's doing pretty well. He has a job and he has a place to live. So
I was underemployed for like a year though, and I was like really unhappy about it.
No, that's true. But you you turned it into a job at the Prospect. We should all be so lucky, right? So we should also probably talk about Dr. Laura, which I think Jamel's blogged a lot about, and he's going to tell us a little bit more about Dr. Laura now, his new best buddy.
Yes, she is my new best buddy. So basically, I'm sure if you're listening to this podcast, odds are you've already heard this story. But because it's hilarious, it's worth recounting. So sometime, was it last week that this all went down? Late last week?
I think so.
It was late last week.
So Dr. Laura Schlesinger, a certified physiologist who plays a psychiatrist on the radio, took a call from an African-American caller. The African-American caller was upset. She's in an interracial marriage with a white man, and her husband's friends and family say racist things to her on a regular basis. And she's dealt with it for a while, but she's really just tired of it, and she called Dr. Laura to get her insight.
My husband ignores those comments, and it hurts my feelings. And he just acts like he
didn't. Can you give me an example of a racist comment? Because sometimes people are hypersensitive. So tell me give me two good examples of racist comments.
Okay, last night, good example. We had a neighbor come over, and this neighbor, every time he comes over, it's always a black comment. It's, oh, well, how do you black people like doing this, and do black people really like doing that? And for a long time, I would ignore it. But last night, I got to the point
where I don't think that's racist.
The stereotype.
I don't think that's racist. No, I think that, no. I think that's, well, listen. Without giving much thought, a lot of blacks voted for Obama simply because he was half black. Didn't matter what he was going to do in office. It was a black thing. You got to know that. That's not a surprise. Not everything that somebody says.
How about the N-word, though? The N-word's been thrown around.
Black guys use it all the time. Turn on HBO, listen to a black comic, and all you hear is nigger, nigger, nigger. I don't get it. If anybody without enough melanin says it, it's a horrible thing. But when black people say it, it's affectionate. It's very confusing. Don't hang up. I want to talk to you some more. Don't go away.
Now, I have to say, I think the first mistake lies with the caller. Why would you call Dr. Laura to ask about something? Like, why not listen to the Tom Joyner Morning Show and call Tom Joyner?
Yeah, it's not a good choice.
There are other people you could have gone to with this problem whose names aren't Dr. Laura. Or at least not Dr. Laura Schlesinger. You know, there might be Dr. Laura Jackson who could help you. Dr. Laura berates the caller, tells her that she's making hay out of nothing. And then, and this is where it gets really odd, goes in this extended, complaint about how it's unfair that she can't use the word nigger like black guys do. Before then, there's a really funny moment where she's, I don't know where this comes from, but she's like, you know, black people do all sorts of crazy things. Like, they all voted for Obama because he was black, not because the dude he was talking about. And it's sort of like, exactly, black people have never voted for Democrats before. It's never happened. unprecedented. So she starts complaining about how it's unfair that black people can use the N-word and she can't. And and admittedly, when she first uses the word, she's basically quoting. She says something to the effect of, you turn on HBO anytime and you see a bunch of black guys saying, nigger, nigger, nigger.
What show is that?
I have no idea.
I was trying to figure that out too.
I've been rewatching The Wire, and like you know, I mean, there's no instance on The Wire where someone has said negative times consecutively. In the rest of the rant, you know, in the rest of the exchange, the caller is like, "I can't believe you used the N word. That's absurd." Dr. Lore is like, "I didn't use it," and then the caller's like, "Yes, you did." And this is actually, I find this really hilarious. Dr. Lore is like, "Yeah, I did. Digger, 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 digger." and then she ends the call by saying, effectively, this is like a rough paraphrase, a rough quote. If you are so sensitive about racism, you shouldn't marry outside your race. The end. Now, I wrote a post about this for The Prospect, and I have to say that, to me, the offensive part wasn't actually her use of the word nigger. In the when she first used it, she's effectively quoting. Like, I was going to say, Monica, if you want to quote a character from The Wire, go ahead. I think there should be allowance within language for using, like, taboo words if you're quoting them. Right. There's, like, limits to that allowance, but generally speaking, it doesn't make a white person racist that they're, like, you know, if it makes no sense to forbid someone from saying, you know, that Tribe Called Quest song, Suck a Nigga, is cool, just because, like, the word nigga is part of the song title. Like, it's part of the song title. It's ridiculous to bar someone from saying that or, like, attack them for saying that. So, for my part, you know, that wasn't the offensive part of Dr. Laura's little rant. The offensive part was everything else. Like, it was her dismissing the caller, her rudeness. It was the racist joke she made to sort of, like, prove her anti-racist bona fides. It was the quip about black people voting for Obama. It was literally every single thing in that entire exchange was, like, either it was, like, chock full of racial resentment, and her use of the N-word was sort of, like, meh. It's like, you shouldn't have said it. You're clearly just being antagonistic, but it's not like you were. No, you didn't call her that.
Right.
What baffles me is I don't understand why there are all these white people who just like are so they're just so burned up by the fact that they can't use the N word. Like it's really funny actually. It's like you have Dr. Laura who's incredibly wealthy and you know successful and everything, but the one thing she doesn't have in her life is the ability to say nigger on the radio whenever she wants. yeah. It's absurd. And I've heard this from other white people, like some older, some my age, sort of like, it's not fair that black people can use the N-word and we can't. Why isn't that fair? Like, what is, explain to me why that is unfair. I mean,
yeah, what are you like, missing out?
What is the injustice there?
It's like, there are plenty of things I don't do that other people do, and I don't find it particularly unfair. I mean, it's like, I'm trying to think of like an analogy here. It's like, I don't call my friend's parents, like, mom and dad. It's like, it's kind of weird.
Want to ever call a woman a bitch or something?
Right, like, my freedom is not abridged by that. Like,
right.
Yeah, I mean, we talked a little bit about this during the Prospect podcast as well, which you all should listen to as well, but, like, part of me thinks that this really just has more to do with the reminder for white people that there is a such thing as a black community and they're not a part of it. And I think some of it goes back to these kinds of historical fears of what will happen if all the black people in the world get together and revisit the crimes paid upon them too. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, it's kind of this like old,
yeah, right.
This old racist fear, right? That, you know, black people are just waiting to get back at white people. You know, also it comes from just this really racist place too, where just the idea that there's like a community of black people that white people aren't a part of that disturbs white people.
Yeah, well, and I think, you know, the thing is, because here we are, we're getting distracted by the N-word, the nigger word. Let's just call it the nigger word. I know that there are people that are uncomfortable with white people saying it, but I've never said that a white person can't say that word. No, what I have said is that you can say it, but you can't try to like measure out what my reaction is going to be to it, right? Like, you're free to say it, but then I'm also free to react in the way that I want. And then we're not really arguing. The people that say, well, you guys can say it, but I can't say it, they're not really arguing the right to say the word. They're arguing the right to say it in my presence, right? Or in in the presence of a black person.
Yeah.
And so that's like the really disturbing part. Like, what do you want to say it in my presence for? Like, what, I mean, under what context? Like, you want to just, like, you know, have a cipher? You know what I'm saying?
This is why I very much believe in, like, the quoting and sort of song lyric exception, right? Like, if it really burns, if you love rap music and you want to, like, you know, sing along to yourself around black people and it just, you're just hampered by the cultural taboo against you saying nigger, then by all means, because you're just singing a song, go ahead and use it. Like, no, like, that's cool. That's fine.
Right.
But any other context, I'm not really sure what you're trying to do here. Right. I think, actually, I'm glad that you said that, Joel, because it reminds me of sort of the part two of the Dr. Laura story, and this is that she announced her retirement from a radio show after sort of the whole fear and outrage directed towards her, and she justified her retirement by saying that I'm going to maintain my First Amendment rights, that I can exercise my First Amendment rights in full when I'm on my website, my blog, and YouTube, and all that jazz. And I find this very, this is like an argument I find very, very, it's particular to conservatives. Like, I've never heard a liberal, or at least like a mainstream liberal, say this. And that's effectively, not only do I have a right to say what I want, but I have a right to avoid criticism for it. Like, the fact that you're calling out my criticism is in and of itself an infringement of my rights, which is absurd. Like, the First Amendment doesn't give you freedom from consequences. It merely says you can say whatever the hell you want, provided you're not, like, inciting people to violence. I think the broader complaint that, like, it's unfair for black people to use the N-word when white people can't is, it's part of this, sort of this belief that, this very privileged belief that I should be able to say nigger, and I shouldn't have to face any consequences for it, and if you get upset about it, you're just being oversensitive. And it's like,
you can't,
really?
We don't have a sense of humor, right?
You're it's like,
yeah.
It's actually so absurd that I can't adequately make fun of it, right? Like,
right.
No, I was just going to say, it's like kind of also part and parcel with this conservative belief that, like, that African Americans really don't have anything to complain about. Like, slavery ended, and so did segregation, and so just, like, just get on with it, right? Like, change your culture and just start succeeding, because we're done with this, right? I think
that's part of it, too. Shit, like, red Kool-Aid, 47 cents a packet at the store, I don't have anything to complain about.
Right.
That was a racist thing for me to say.
Right. And then, you know, here's the thing too. I mean, like, she said something to the effect that, like, I really thought that, like, once Barack got elected, that, like, you know, these complaints about I don't listen to her radio show. I don't know what kind of communicator she really is, but, like, you know, we would stop demonizing white people that hate blacks. Like, that's a direct quote, but maybe, you know, maybe she didn't mean it like that. I'm not really going to give her the benefit of the doubt, though. Like, I don't feel like I have to. And I actually had this debate with some friends. It went on for like 500 emails, right? And it was like, I called her, I think that what she said was racist. And, like, you know, you would have thought that, like, I'd called her like a child molester, right? Like, it just went on, like, why do you think she's a racist? I mean, these are, for the most part, these are a group of black friends, right? But the one person that was involved in this, she's a regular listener of Dr. Lore, and she's white. And, you know, they kept saying, well, you know, we've got to stop saying the N-word, and it's a terrible thing. And I was just like, you know, let's stop, like, getting distracted by that. I was like, because, like, I don't understand, like, why we're having all this conversation about, like, nigger. Like, what, like, really, like, we need to stop that shit, like, today. Because it's, like, inspired a lot of really stupid pieces on the internet, and, like, I really want it to stop. Like, I really would like us to, like, focus on, like, the other, like, patently racist, stupid shit that she said.
It's kind of the same conversation as culture, too, right? Where it's like, you know, it's this conversation about whether it is that African Americans are kind of like doing this to themselves, when of course that's like not at all true. But this like idea, the concentrating on the N-word is like easier, right? It's like, it's easier than like addressing the fact, like for white people, it's easier than addressing the fact that they benefit from a system in which automatically favors them. And there's kind of no way for them to get out of that. There's no way for them to not be culpable. You know, and I don't know what it is for, you know, broadly, why it is that that is like more appealing than talking about the socioeconomic structures and the legal barriers to succeeding.
Because it's easier. It's a stupider conversation. Like, it's a conversation for, like, I mean, I don't mean to, well, no, I'm going to go ahead and say, it's a conversation for dumb people. Like, you know what I mean? Like it's easier to get engaged in, like, we should not say nigger. Because it's something that, like, everybody's, like, grandparents, you know, it's like, the NAACP buried the word. Like, it's just much easier to have that conversation than to talk about, like, some of the other really troubling things that she had said, you know, like, well, we really have to, like, confront some of these other issues about, you know, like, even the like, well, you shouldn't date outside of your race if you don't have a sense of humor. Like, what the fuck? Like, what are you talking about? Like, so I should just, like, allow my wife to, like, just, you know, just, hey, nigga, you know, just come in, you know, and her friends and family, you know, they should just have, you know, carte blanche to do that, you know, but I must not be funny enough, you know? But go ahead.
I want to add one last thing, and that's, I think this, I mean, I think one interesting thing going on here too is it's just more another indication that to a lot of people, being accused of racism or like identifying racism is far more offensive than actual discrimination and prejudice against minorities, right? Like, like, it's like beyond the pale to call Dr. Laura racist, but the actual racist things she said are sort of overlooked. Anti-racism is like a real thing, that you shouldn't call people racist because it's mean. As a word, racist and racism has become this sort of like ontological category, right? Like, it's not just that you said a racist thing or that you like you made a racist insinuation. It's that like if I went to someone and said that thing you just said was racist, what they would hear is, I'm a Klansman.
Yeah.
Right.
It's hard to disentangle like racism as a category of being from racism as like qualities of particular actions. And maybe you can't separate them, but it'd be nice to try, if only because we can sort of knock into people's heads that just because you did something racist doesn't mean you're necessarily like Bull Connor.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. And that's exactly the conversation that I was having earlier this week, is that, you know, they're saying, well, you know, calling somebody a racist is like a really terrible thing and you don't want to. And I was like, no. I mean, being the racist is the problem. You know, like,
I also think, I mean, for purposes of like constructive conversation, I think it's usually easier to talk about privilege as a way to kind of get into racism. Because I do think that like, most of the time that most people are racist, it comes from a place of ignorance or just like a failure to understand the place that they occupy vis-a-vis someone else. But Dr. Laura was racist. Like, it wasn't, she wasn't being like white privileged. Right. She was just being a racist person.
Yeah.
So. Should we move on to our
Shoutouts. Yeah, I was just gonna say, if everybody's done, we can go ahead and move to our shoutouts. So, Joel, is your shoutout another Canadian city this week, or do you
have? Yeah, right. Like Montreal. What's up? Hamilton. I really don't have anything. This is weird. I guess, you know, I'm gonna shout out. And I said it earlier. Like, I got hit on Twitter by like one of my favorite rappers of all time earlier this week, Rascass. He's a dude that like probably me and like 30 people have heard of before, because his fame lasted maybe for like 3 weeks in 1996. But he was, and I mean, maybe later he was like, you know, known for like beefing with the game like everybody else. But like, he released like an awesome album in '96. It was Soul on Ice, and I spent like the first semester of my college freshman year, trying to get that album. And so, you know, I'm going to be spinning that this week. Y'all need to jump on some, you know, Nation of the Threat, Miami Life, all that good stuff, because it was a classic album and it really was overlooked. So I've been kind of bumping that a little bit. I wish I had something better. You know, Melinda made pizza tonight, my wife. You know, I always shout out food on here. So, but other than that, what's up, Canada? That's it. That's it for me.
Jamel, do you have a shout out?
Yeah, I have two. The first is I'm going to shout out the lovely Kennebunk, Maine. I was there with my girlfriend Tess 2 weekends ago for a friend's wedding. Nice place. It was funny, to me at least, to be like one of 10 black people in like the whole state.
I was going to say Kennebunkport is like, that's like the whitest place I could ever imagine.
Well, there's Kennebunkport and there's Kennebunk. Kennebunkport is a little further down. We were just in good old Kennebunk, and it was nice. The second shout out is for the podcast. It's been a long time since I've been on this podcast, and I'm glad to subject our listeners to my monotone and occasional inanity. Glad to be back.
So I was going to shout out this brewing company called Clipper City Brewing Company, and it's based in Baltimore. And you can get their brews, I think, in the D.C. and Baltimore area. And they just have a lot of really good beers, and they're made locally. And someone brought them to my house for a dinner party a couple weeks ago, and I've been slowly sampling them all. And I can tell you that they're all quite good. I enjoy them a great deal at my house.
You're all right.
So. as opposed to in the street on the bus.
On my stoop. I mean, I totally started to bond with my neighbors who sit on their stoop and drink every night. And so when we're done with the podcast, that might be what's happening.
Ah, very good.
Is me taking a beer and sitting out on the stoop with my neighbors, but we'll see.
Dangerous, man. All right. I mean, where I come from, that's like a neighborhood that we don't turn down. Like where I come from in Houston, like if you turn down a neighborhood and like there are people sitting out on their porch drinking beer, like it's just like I'm gonna go down the next block, you know.
But those are the nicest people.
That's how y'all roll. Yeah.
I always live in neighborhoods where people drink on their stoop, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah. No. Oh, well, we have not shouted out the running challenge, folks, man, by the way.
That's something. Yeah, we definitely should do that. Yeah.
New people.
Yeah, what's up? Next month, are you in? What's up, Jamel? Are you down? Yeah.
I'm not joining this running challenge.
What? What's wrong?
I'm not doing it.
Oh, man. Yeah, okay, well, let me explain. You know, and really it's our founder, the founder of Post Bougie, Gene, who kind of got this started. He's like an avid runner and a machine, you know. But, you know, it kind of started out, you know, a couple people were like, oh, I'm going to run so many miles this month, and I'm going to run so many miles this month. And then slowly it kind of like grew. And so I think maybe now we have maybe about, 20 people, Monica, doing the challenge. There's some people running 25 miles, some running 50, some running 75, some running 100, and some crazy people that are running 125 in the space of a month. And we're just kind of keeping chart, every few days. And it's really kind of inspiring because there's a lot of people in there. I mean, it kind of keeps you motivated. Like, I mean, it's really easy to, like, when you're doing it by yourself and you're getting up in the morning and you're just like, oh, man, I'm not doing this. It's, you know, humid outside. But, like, when you know you've got to be accountable to some cool people and, you know, they suggest some really good music and or just, like, just the problems of running out on the street, you know that you're not alone. So it's really been good, and it's kept me getting up every morning and trying to get out there. So I think Jamel said that he'll be doing it next week or next month.
No. I walk to work every day. It's about 3 miles of walking every day. I'm cool with that. I'm cool. All right, guys, I think this is the end of the podcast. And so on behalf of Joel and Monica, this is Jamel. And thank you for listening.
Our theme music is 8. By Aeon. You can catch us at postbougie.com.
one of us to say done.
Are we doing this again?
Just say done. Just say the word done.
Dig it. Dig it. Dig it. Dig it.
Done.
All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us on behalf of Jamel and Joel. Have a really good week, and please visit us next time again.
That's horrible. I'm sorry.
Damn!
What was that?
Wow!
You gotta do that again.
Okay. Wow. Wait. Okay, everybody, thanks for joining us this week on behalf of Jamel and Joel. Thanks for listening, and we hope to... No, I messed up. You messed me up. All right, everybody, thanks for joining us this week. This is Monica again, and on behalf of Jamel and Joel, thanks for joining us, and we hope you join us again next time.
Could you say join one more time?
Why are you being so? It's not that. Well, come on, dude. It's like 11 o'clock.
I know. So get it right, and so we can close it.
I think this might be the outtakes right here.
Yeah, possible. Yeah.
All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us. This is Monica. On behalf of Jamel and Joel, thanks for joining us. We'll see you again next week. That's not true, right?
That's not true.
Oh my god.
All right, wait, I'll do it for real this time, wait.
Okay.
For real.
All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. This is Monica on behalf of somebody else should do this.
Yeah. Does somebody else want to do it?
Oh, wow. I'll give it a shot, but I see I'm stepping into the, like, you know, I'm kind of, like, psyched out now. I don't know if I want to. Oh, man. All right, I think I'll do it. I'll try it. Let's see.
All right.
Well, I think we're at the end, guys. And I think for Monica, Jamel, this is Joel. And we'll see you guys or hear from you guys later. Oops. That was terrible.
Okay. Let me do it. All right.
Oh, man.